Very good. So I have just returned from another overseas trip, sharing myself with others over in Penang and last night in Singapore, with old and young as well. One of the little things which I did was just to give a nice talk to a little youth camp in Singapore yesterday afternoon. And of course, that everybody knows it's New Year coming tomorrow or the next day. And so a lot of times people are asking me just how to face the new year and what can Buddhism offer to make the life a more peaceful, happy, prosperous, basically a more smiley next year. And I remember this one little 15-year-old girl. She said to me with a lot of pathos and really serious concern, say, is the world really going to end in 2012? I'm only 15. It's not fair. It's not fair for a 15-year-old. But it brought to mind just how that most people just have so much negativity and fear that whenever we look at anything, we add so much negativity to it. And our world, the place in which we live. Now, sometimes that, the world is this, but what we really experience as a world is what we add to this world. Just like when I was a kid, we used to have these drawing books, black lines on white paper, and you draw them in. And you had a choice to draw in beautiful colors or pastel colors. And for me, I'd always love to draw in the bright colors because I had a very positive mind. So on the fabric of life, you wove these beautiful patterns, or you could wove unpleasant patterns. It's what you add to the life seems to be the most important. And that's one thing as Buddhists we can teach people, how to change the attitude towards life, how to add this beautiful positive way of looking at life. How to make use of these negative things and turn them totally around into something wonderful. So I told this girl, 2012, like 2 weeks ago, I gave a talk on something similar. And I mention it because I noticed that it's not 2012 next year, because we follow the Buddhist calendar. Next year is 2,555. So 2012, that was 400 years ago. We're way advanced. And also, I noticed that the Buddhist year 2,555, that because I was in Thailand for so many years, you know what the Thai word for five is? It's ha. So 2,555 means two, ha, ha, ha. So it's going to be a very funny year next year. Ha, ha, ha year. And why not just add that positive part to the perception? You can look at 2012 and see all the terrible things which might happen, or 2,555, turn it around and give it this positive spin to it. And really, that's the meaning of our lives. Now, we can't change life so much, but we can certainly change our attitude towards our life. So, yeah, New Year tomorrow is always the case. People look, see what's happened. And what do most people say? It's gone so fast. 12 months. Come on. If it has gone fast, there's only one reason why. It's because you weren't here when it was happening. And you've missed it. How much of your life have you really been here? And how much have you been going somewhere? As for me, I learned a long time ago, no, I'm not going anywhere. People think I travel around a lot. I don't travel around a lot. I just sit down. The plane moves. I don't move. The car wheels go around, but I sit perfectly still. If you ever notice in life, even wherever you go, there you are. Now, that's very profound. It means you're not really going anywhere. It means that all this idea of I'm going to get somewhere, that's, where is he? He's here somewhere tonight. Somebody that I was, no, he's not here tonight, I just remembered he comes on Saturday afternoons. I was busy next door just taking some papers into the office because I also have to do administration work sometimes. And as I was taking those papers into the office, he just happened to ask me, he said, Ajahn Brahm, how are you? And you know what I answered? I said, I'm getting there. And that's a wrong thing to say because he was smart enough to give the usual riposte, where are you going to? And I realized that was the wrong answer. Because where was I going to? Where are you going to? Where are we all going to? There's only one place we're really going to, or rather one of three places, I say, here in Western Australia, Karrakatta, Pinneroo, or Fremantle. Which are the three main cemeteries in Perth. That's where we're getting to. So instead of getting somewhere, instead of going somewhere, instead of going places, when anybody asks me now, said, how are you? I never say, I'm getting there. I say, I'm being here. It's a much better answer, being here, rather than getting somewhere. So, yeah, there's 2 days, or a day and a half left of 2011. Enjoy it. There's a whole day and a half left. That's probably, what is it now, 28 hours. That is about, 1,440 minutes. That's 85,000 seconds, 850,000 seconds, almost a million seconds. Why do we just keep wasting things and throwing things away, waiting for something to happen? It's many years ago. There was a fellow monk, he was from New Zealand, and he told me this story. I haven't told this story for a long time here. He told me this story, that he was on one of these meditation retreats. Now, these meditation retreats he was on was in the country of Korea, and they were really tough monks in Korea. And this was one of the toughest of monasteries. They used to do every year a 60-day retreat. And they'd have to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Not 4 o'clock, not 5, 3 o'clock every morning. And had to be sitting there 5 minutes later. And the whole day was 50 minutes of meditation and then 10 minutes of walking. Then back down again, 50 minutes of meditation. Another 10 minutes of walking throughout the day till about 10 o'clock at night. And even being one of these old Korean Buddhist monasteries, where you meditated, that's where you ate. And that's where you slept at 10 o'clock. You lay down, and when the bell went, bang, you had to wake up and start meditating again. It was very tough. And even toilet breaks you had to ask permission for. It was really, really tough. And this was a young Kiwi monk. And he told me just after the first day, just how much it hurt. The legs were aching. The back was sore. And he had another 59 days to go. Oh, that was difficult. And when he lay down to sleep just to rest and to stretch his legs, before he knew it, the bell went and off it was again. And those first 3 or 4, 5, 6, 7 days were hell. And many times he thought of leaving and running away. But he saw all these Asian monks sitting perfectly still. And he thought, no, that's letting down my country. I am going to sit for New Zealand. And so he endured just out of national pride. And after 2 weeks, he could stand no more. Even visiting the teacher was very strict because they had these big sticks over there, and if you asked the wrong question, bang, really tough place. So after 2 weeks, he was really in trouble. But he thought, no, I've endured 2 whole weeks. If I run away now, that would be like unfaithful to all the hard effort I put in.
So every day, every hour was a struggle. But he really put forth immense endurance. And soon you got to the halfway mark. And when you get to the halfway mark, you know, you think you're almost home. But when halfway in anything in life, the first half is much shorter than the second half. Even though it's the same number of days, the time appears much, much longer. So the next week was like 2 weeks. Now the sixth week was like a whole month. And he was just wondering whether he'd ever survive. But he kept on going. It was just an immense endurance feat. 7 weeks, only 1 week to go, only 7 days. But 7 days were like 7 years. And every day got longer and longer. But doesn't matter how hard it is in life, eventually you get to the last day. And he woke up on that last day, already feeling he'd achieved so much. But all that aches and pains, it was as if it was just playing with him before. Now it was getting serious. Sometimes he ached so much he felt like crying. Sometimes he wondered whether he would survive. That last day dragged and dragged and dragged in agony until the last meditation, almost to the end. Only another 45 minutes to endure. But those 45 minutes were the most painful of them all. Every now and again, he opened his eyes to look at the clock. He was sure half an hour had gone past, but only 5 minutes. He started to wonder, maybe the batteries in the clock were flat. Maybe the batteries would run out and the clock would get stuck. That was really unfair. But the batteries weren't flat. It was just time got slower and slower as the minutes got longer. That's what it's like when you're waiting for something to end. But finally the sweetest sound he'd ever heard, the sound of the gong. The end of the retreat. Now 60 days. Of such endurance. He felt so great. He'd done something really difficult. He felt really proud of himself. He'd made it. And he was, because in that tradition, after such retreats, you know, all the monks do go and relax. They have hot baths. You know, in the Korean, these beautiful hot baths where you can really relax. And all the aches and pains can go away. And there was like a feast, a celebration after the end of the retreat. And he was just thinking of the hot bath and the beautiful feast and be able just to walk and just take it easy when the teacher rang the bell again. I want your attention, everybody. During the interviews, some of you have told me how much you have benefited from this 60-day meditation retreat. And in those interviews, you've asked me, can we extend the retreat for another 10 days? And having considered your request, I think it's a good one. The retreat is extended for another 10 days. Cross your legs and carry on meditating. And that poor monk, he told me personally, he never experienced any pain anymore. He couldn't even feel his legs. He was consumed with anger. And he wanted to find out who those damn monks were, those smart asses who said those things to their teacher, and what he was going to do with them afterwards was nothing any Buddha should ever contemplate. And he was thinking all the ways he could find out and what he was going to do to them. And about 15 minutes passed. You know, as a second. Because when you're really upset and angry, time goes incredibly fast. The bell went again. And the teacher said, retreat is now over. And he thought, hang on, I thought we were meditating for another 10 days. And now he says the retreat's over. What's going on? And then one of the monks sitting next to him, who'd been doing these retreats for many years, leaned over to the New Zealand monk and said, oh, the teacher, he does the same trick every year. Because the message of that exercise was teaching you, when you expect something to happen, that causes the pain and the misery and the anger. When we have plans that now the bath, the food is going to happen, and those plans are thwarted, we think it's not going to happen. That's where we get angry. We want to kill somebody. It's not anyone's fault except our plans are too rigid. We don't adapt. We think, oh, it must happen now. It has to happen now. When it doesn't happen, we get very upset. And when we're waiting for something to happen, that's when it gets really, really painful and difficult. And we're wasting all these precious moments of just being here. So don't wish away a day and 4 hours of your life. Every day is the beginning of the new year. And our job is to put a positive attitude towards whatever we're doing right now or however we're going to face the future. I gave a new simile in Singapore last night. And it's a simile of the future is a frog. Have you ever heard that saying before? The future is a frog. You have. How did you hear that? I only invented it yesterday. You're really up to date. So you must have listened to the talk on the internet. The future is a frog. And what I mean by that is that sometimes it depends, you know, what we think of a frog. That sometimes we think, oh, it's going to be a terrible future. Sometimes there's the European debt crisis, climate change, war, cancer, all sorts of things are going to go wrong in the future. And that's the negativity. That's like the ugly frog. But Buddhism, or just common sense, teaches us kindness and compassion. So be kind and compassionate towards the future. I call that kissing the frog. Because the frog is really a beautiful princess or a wonderful prince. And all they need is a kiss. And they will, the spell of negativity put upon them by the wicked witch of maybe politicians, the media, or negativity, no matter what you call it. The wicked witch of stupidity turns that beautiful princess or prince into that ugly frog. And of course, all you need to do to get rid of that terrible smell, not smell, spell, maybe smell as well, I don't know. I've never kissed a frog, but it probably does smell. But to get rid of that terrible spell is to kiss that ugly frog, and they turn into their true nature, which is a beautiful prince or a wonderful princess. Actually, the old story, like this very, very rich pop star or this beautiful supermodel. Does that work better than a prince or a princess? I don't know, but anyway, the future, if you kiss it with kindness, you change your attitude, you embrace it with some compassion, it changes into something which is delightful and interesting and something even to look forward to. So whenever you think of the future, 2012, 13, 14, 2555, when you think of that, if you add that little bit of kindness and compassion to it, if you embrace it, if you kiss it with the kindness, then it turns into something incredibly beautiful and wonderful. You're not changing the world, but you are changing the attitude towards the world. So, tomorrow, your wife has got you to mow the garden. Tomorrow, your husband has got you to, I don't know, to clean up the kitchen. Sometimes we can have so much negativity towards them. I don't want to clean up the kitchen. I don't want to mow the lawn. I don't want to do any of these things. But instead, we can make it a beautiful experience. add the positive part of it. Because the story, the key story which changed my life about doing things which I didn't like to do, that was the story of Ajahn Chah's main hall, the main building in my teacher's monastery in Thailand. He built this beautiful ordination hall. But because the land was flat and because sometimes it flooded, he raised it up on a hill. Not a man-made hill, a monk-made hill. We had to cut all the earth. Actually, I wasn't there cutting the earth. But when it was all finished, there was a whole heap of earth left over. So Ajahn Chah called all the monks, not just from his monastery, from neighboring monasteries. That's how I got involved. He called us over to please help tidy up after the main hall was built. Now, I had a lot of faith and a lot of gratitude from my teachers. Ajahn Chah taught me so much and got so much gratitude for him. So when he wanted some help, of course, I'm very happy to spend 3 days, you know, shoveling the earth into wheelbarrows, pushing them, move all the dirt to a place he told us to put it in just round the back. Even though it is really, really hard work. Now, it was exceptionally hard work because, you know, this was a time when you know, I was really malnourished. You know, not like these days, but in those days, you know, it was sticky rice and frogs, sticky rice and snails, anything which slithered on the ground, that's what we ate. I was told the first thing I was told when I went to that monastery, don't ask what's in the curry. That was the first piece of advice I was given. So that's really disgusting food. I mean, really disgusting food sometimes. I've told the story of a frog on rice. Sometimes, once we had frog soup. Frog soup was just like this big pot. And you looked inside and there was all these frogs floating on the back, on the top, just small frogs about this size. There was no sauce. There was no, there was no sort of chilies. There was no sort of garlic. There's not even any salt. It was just the frogs that just fallen in some water and just boiled. And do they have any of those recipes on those celebrity chef shows? Do they ever serve boiled frog soup? And that's all we had. No fruit, no vegetables, nothing, just boiled frog soup and sticky rice. That was really disgusting because you just managed to put one of those little frogs on those Chinese spoons and without thinking, if you thought you'd be in big trouble, put it in your mouth and go crunch. And that's what it was. That's true. I'm not exaggerating. That was our one meal of the day, frog soup and rice. So, you know, it's not just that it didn't taste very nice. You know, even the frogs were malnourished, so they were really thin, skin and bones. But it's a very poor part of the world. So I was really malnourished. I didn't have any energy or much sort of strength. And so for 3 days we had to push these wheelbarrows full of earth. And now from usually after our meal of, you know, the frog soup and rice, we finished about 9:15. So by 9:30 we're pushing these things all day, all afternoon, you know, till about sort of 9 o'clock at night, you know, because we used to get lanterns to show the way so we could keep pushing this earth. Really hard work for 3 days. But, you know, you had faith. After the 3 days, I was so happy it was finished that now I could sort of have a shower and, you know, maybe have a sleep in the following morning and, you know, wash your clothes and get back to some meditation. But you know what happened that night? That night, Ajahn Chah left for another monastery to go visiting. And the next morning, the deputy abbot called all us monks together and said, I think we've moved it in the wrong place. It didn't look good where it was. He had a point. So he said, would you mind moving it? So another 3 days of hard work, being malnourished in the jungles of Thailand, hot, sweaty, covered with mosquitoes. It was very, very tough work. But we did it. 6 days of really tough work. And tomorrow I could have my nice shower. But what happened? That night, Ajahn Chah, my teacher, came back. And in the morning, after our one meal of the day, he got us all together and said, I told you to move it over there. Why is it over the other place? Move it where I've told you to. Another 3 days of hard work. Slogging, pushing wheelbarrows in the hot sun in the jungle. Just eaten to death by mosquitoes. That's when I lost my faith. I think, because these senior monks, they don't push the wheelbarrows. They just, you know, just tell us where to push it. You know what it's like having bosses at work. You do all the work, and they just tell you what to do, and you haven't done it right. So I was getting very upset. I didn't become a monk to do physical labor. I became a monk to meditate, maybe study, you know, to have a nice, calm, and peaceful life. I never realized that was not in the contract, you know, to do physical labor. You know, if I had had the telephone number of Kevin Reynolds, I would have called him and got him to get us to go on strike. Kevin Reynolds is one of the big union people here in sort of Western Australia. But there was no choice. So the next day, there I was, pushing these heavy wheelbarrows. But I was not happy. I was really upset. I was, just like any Westerner would do, was swearing. Swearing in English so the Thais wouldn't understand. So I thought. But even though you were swearing in a foreign language, people could see your body language. They knew you were not happy. And that was when one of the monks came up to me and just gave me one of these one-line teachings. And if this is all you hear this evening, this is worth coming for. The teaching was, this monk said to me, pushing the wheelbarrow is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part. And I was wise enough and open enough to hear him consider it and practice it. When I stopped complaining, the wheelbarrow was far easier to push. And those 3 days, the next 3 days, went by so happily. Having good fun, joking with the fellow monks, sometimes racing the wheelbarrows so you can get there first. Putting fun into it rather than swearing. And it was true. Doing things is very easy. Thinking about it is the tough part. And from that time on, whenever I had a very difficult job to do, whenever I had a big task in front of me, when I had so many things on my plate, I always remember that. Doing it is easy. Thinking about it, that's the hard part. So make it easy for yourself. Don't think, don't plan. Who knows what's going to happen? In other words, put the positive spin on whatever you're going to do. So, 2012, solving the problem of climate change. Thinking about it becomes impossible. Doing it is much easier. That's the trouble. We spend too much time thinking, and too little time doing. So that's why, as monks, we have got all of our thinking in check. We don't think so much. That's why we can do so much. We're not wasting all our energy in this useless stuff between our ears. So remember, whatever task you have to do in life, going to the dentist, going to get the biopsy, going to work, going to an interview for a new job, whatever it is you've got to do in life which you're not looking forward to, doing it is the easy part. Thinking about it makes it tough. And that is actually why that monk, you know, who was just thinking about only another day to go, only another 3 months, only another 3 minutes to go, only another minute to go. That was the cause of all the anger and upset. So please, don't anticipate the future and go thinking about it. Just do the present moment, do it well, and then you'll have a wonderful, easy life. So, you know, for the future there, just don't even think about it. Just do the future. Don't think about it and worry about it, because that is where things start going terribly wrong. So if one can just train the mind in these very, very simple teachings, not just thinking about things, but doing things. Just not worrying about them, not swearing, but enjoying them. Changing the attitude towards life is all one needs to do. And if one can change the attitude towards your life, towards whatever you're doing, it really becomes fun. Even when the negative stuff happens in life, you know, the cancers, the divorces, the what else happens? Now, when people sort of scold you, I remember reading when I was a long time ago about this Greek philosopher and teacher, many centuries ago, because in those ancient times, you know, in Greece, that one wise teacher would have a number of students, and they'd teach them everything from mathematics to sort of a little bit of science to, you know, rhetoric, how to debate with people. They would teach them everything, and obviously like a bit of accounting. So when these students had graduated from one of these teachers, now after many, many years, they were very, very easily employed. But this one particular teacher had an idiosyncrasy. His idiosyncrasy, his really strange little part which separated from other teachers in ancient Greece, was that whenever he scolded one of his disciples would have to pay an extra dollar to the teacher. Every time you were told off, you'd have to pay a dollar. Because obviously telling someone off, you know what it's like telling someone off, it's not a pleasant thing to do, and your teacher's only doing that out of kindness. He really wants to teach you and help you, make sure you don't make a mistake anymore. So every time the teacher told the student off, he had to pay him an extra dollar. And after he graduated, he went to work. And whenever he was at work, whenever his boss scolded him, he'd only laugh. Every time he was scolded, he just laughed. And after a while, they said, "Why do you laugh? Are you crazy? You're being scolded." Usually when people get scolded, they get upset and angry. But all you do is smile and laugh. He said, "Why?" He said, "Because I remember my teacher in the old days. I had to pay for this. Now I get it for free." And that was a wonderful little story there. Because, so, maybe you can, your kids, every time you tell them off, as a mother or a father, get them to pay you a dollar. Which means that when they grow up, when they get scolded by their wife, they will just start laughing. When their boss tells them off, they'll think it's so funny because they get it for free. Therefore, they will never get upset. Because it's a scolding. Some people say something rotten to you, but why do you get upset? It's just the attitude which we give to the negative things which happen to us in life. And the other things which happen to us in life, the disappointments. Those disappointments in life, that's actually where we learn. If life never gave you any challenges, what would be the purpose of life? If you didn't have any difficulties in life, now, how would you ever grow? Sometimes people ask you, you know, what is the meaning of life? And as far as I'm concerned, the meaning of life is to grow, to learn, you know, to become a better human being. And to become a better human being, I don't mean physically stronger, because, you know, that's impossible. When you get to my age, you're really going downhill. Now, that's one of the reasons why time goes much quicker the older you get, because the further you go downhill, the more you pick up speed. But anyhow, you don't really grow in physical strength, but certainly, you know, you grow in your wisdom and your compassion and all the things which will stay with you for the whole of your life. And in Buddhism, we say will be there for you in your next life as well. The compassion, the wisdom, you know, the forgiveness, those wonderful qualities, that is the meaning of life, to actually to grow in them. And so whenever we do get a challenge in life, a difficulty, a death in the family, that's there to teach us a lesson so that we can become wise enough that when some things like this happen, we understand the meaning, we understand the lesson. Why do people die, and why do we react the way we do when people die? Now, it's not that, you know, like we're too attached. Being attached is fine, but it's attached with no wisdom. So when they're with you, yeah, attach to them. Enjoy your wife, enjoy your husband, enjoy your kids. But when it's time for them to go, that's when you let them go. Now, when I was riding a bicycle, I always made sure I was very attached to the seat. For obvious reason. But when I got off that bicycle, I let it go. That's what we really mean. Sort of, yeah, when it's time to be attached, but when it's time to let go, we can let go the first possible opportunity. Now, that's the same with, you know, the people you love. You love them, you attach to them, you care for them, but when the moment comes, that's when you have to let them go. And you let them go with peace, with happiness. How can you do that with happiness? And the reason is, the way you do it with happiness, you look back at the positive, the big picture positive attitude of having been with someone for so many years. You know, when I first started doing funeral services and counseling people in grief, you know, one of the things I'd always say to them, said, would you rather never have met that person? Would you rather never have known your father or your mother? So what sort of question is that? Of course, it was a wonderful time I had with my mother. Exactly, you had a wonderful time with her. All those great years, those wonderful experiences. You're so lucky having been with a person like that. And whereas, yeah, actually I was quite lucky to have had a wonderful mother. So why are you crying? Crying at a death is only when we focus at what's been taken away. And we don't look at all of what we've had in life. This is terrible negativity which only sees what's wrong and is fully oblivious and forgets, you know, what we've had. You've had this wonderful time with this person. Whether it's 50 years or 5 years or 5 hours. Isn't it wonderful that you've known someone, had so much fun and enjoyed their company? Why can't we look at that instead of what's been taken away? It's the same event. Look upon it from two different angles, of another angle, and we find it's not painful at all. We're actually learning. What we're actually learning is to enjoy the moment, to enjoy each other's company. But to enjoy each other's company, knowing that one day that we will part. That's nature. You can't stop that. And to accept that. Not to fight the world and try and change it, but fight the way we look at it and be a bit wiser. And if that happens, you do become wise to the fact that you have to let go of everything beloved and pleasing to us. It doesn't make you dull or negative or depressed. What it does is you understand you've had a wonderful time with that person. Now you have to let them go. And as other people come into your lives afterwards. I know what it's like when somebody dies. You think that's the end of the world, but of course it doesn't end. 2012 is not the end of the world. The death of your loved one isn't the end of the world. Getting cancer is not the end of the world. Losing your job is not the end of the world. There is no such thing as the end of the world. This world has a habit of going on. And just life has got the habit of continuance. So there's no such thing as the end of the world. So when we see it that way, whatever happens in our life, we carry on. We carry on, and we've got the choice to carry on with bitterness or with wisdom. It's the same when any of you have had a bad experience in the past year. A terrible thing has happened to you. A rotten experience. You've lost all your money on the stock market. You've lost your wife. Your kid has gone to jail. You've got, I don't know what else has happened. What else can happen? Your football team lost all its matches. Your cricket team has lost all the test matches. I don't know whatever cricket team you support. But I know that Sri Lanka wasn't doing all that good last year. But whatever matter, if you look at it that way, you can just get so depressed because all you ever notice is the negative part of life. Instead, you can think of a positive way. It's great in the Australian rules football because the worse you do, the more chance you get to pick the best players next year. So that's why losing is actually a positive. The next time that something goes wrong in life, look for the positive. You lose your job, it means you can take a rest and go on holiday. You get cancer, which means you can have a really nice break and find out how many people really care for you and love you. So whatever happens in life, you can always look upon it in a beautiful way. And that's why that in that little book which I wrote, the Opening the Door of Your Heart, the US version was called Who Ordered This Truckload of Dung? And in that dung book, whatever happens in life, it is shit. It is fertilizer. It is things which you can grow beautiful gardens out of. And that's a wonderful story, which means whatever's happened in 2011, all the terrible things, you've been so lucky. You had so much shit for your garden. Wow, you're so, so fortunate. Why is it that we look at the shit part of life and we think that's negative? But if you've got lots of money, you've really had a good financial year, why do you think that that is any better than shit? It's the dung which fertilizes the garden. That's why many, many years ago, that even Ajahn Chah, he looked into this money business, and to make a very, very strong point, he said he actually made a prediction that one day the world will run out of paper, so we won't be able to print banknotes on paper anymore. One day the world will run out of metal, so we won't have any coins. So we'll have to think of something else to use for money. And so he predicted that in the future they would use chicken shit for money. Because they have these little pellets which you'll put in your pocket. And if you want a hamburger, 10 pellets of chicken shit, please. And you'd really be worrying about who's got the most chicken shit. And when you go to get a job, you'll ask, how much chicken shit do you give me every month? And you'd be looking in the newspapers of the house, how much chicken shit, how many big piles does it cost to get your new house? And the banks will be full of it. And the IMF will be renamed the International Manure Fund. Because he said, what is the difference between pellets of chicken poo and money? It's just the value we give to them. And that's why, these metals, like diamonds, they're just stones out of the ground. And it's just because of the value we give to it that it's really, really important. So after a while, when you understand this, it's a value you give to things. So why not give more value to the beautiful but tough experiences of life? Because that monk in that story, he said that last 20 minutes of meditation, when he was thinking who he's going to kill, he said he actually learned much more about life from that last 20 minutes than he did over 60 days of meditation. He learned about expectation. He learned about just why it is when we've got such hard and fast plans and expectations, that is where a lot of our suffering comes from. A lot of our pain, when we think, oh, it's going to happen. Oh, tomorrow we're going to go somewhere, visit somewhere, get the check. And when it doesn't happen, that's when we get so upset and angry. But look, your plans and expectations. The one thing, one of the great teachings of the Buddha was whatever you expect it's going to be, it's always something else. You cannot predict the future. I can't even predict tomorrow. I can't even predict the next thing I'm going to say. It just comes out, good or bad, I don't know. But life is so unpredictable. Certainly my life has been unpredictable. I never thought when I was a kid I was going to end up as a monk. I would never thought even a few years ago I'd end up just giving a talk, streaming throughout the world from a little hall in a suburb of Perth. So life is incredibly unpredictable. You don't know what's going to happen next. So stop worrying about it. If you really want to worry about something, worry about something which you can do something about. The future you can't do anything about. It just evolves. In which particular way, leave it alone. Which means that life is interesting. Not knowing what 2012 will bring. The only prediction I can give for next year is that I can't predict it. I don't know what. It's going to surprise me. I'm sure that's going to happen. And the same for you. So remember, just be open for the surprises, open for the unexpected, open just to adapt to whatever situation arises, and then you'll always be successful. If it's a happy life, a happy 2012, lots of joyful moments, well done, you've deserved that. Enjoy it. If it's trouble and difficulty, well done, enjoy it. More dung for my garden. So whatever happens to you in life, because it's a learning experience, it's a growing experience, if you have the right attitude, you can't change the world, but you can change your attitude, year by year become a wiser, compassionate, more peaceful person. And it's great to see such people who, that you know, sometimes that you know you get the disappointment and the difficulty, and people just don't get upset. And it's great when people see that no matter what happens in life, they can lose a contract. You know, the difficulty happens. They can make a mistake. They can crash the car. Whatever happens in life, you can always have it the positive attitude. We crashed a car. Well, we really needed a new car. Now we have to get one. Well done. If you can't afford a new car, wonderful. Now I can make sure I don't emit so many greenhouse gases. I can get a bicycle. It's good for my health. Whatever happens in life, you can always turn it to something beautiful and good. That's what I always said a long time ago. That, you know, if ever I run out of stories to give and to talk on a Friday night, be wonderful. Then you'll leave me alone. You say, Ajahn Brahm, we don't want you at Nolamara anymore. Then I can really enjoy myself being peaceful, meditating in my cave. So whatever happens in life, it's always a win-win situation, because the attitude you give to life, whatever happens, is brilliant, is beautiful. So if I die young, actually 60, is that young? Well, if I die at 60, great, I don't have to go through old age. So if you die old, brilliant. You know, you can live a bit longer and just help people much longer. Whatever happens, you always think of it as win-win, positive, positive. So remember, just thinking about it is the hard part. If you are going to think about it in a beautiful way, in a good way, instead of getting into so much negativity in life. So 2012, the new year, it is a new year. New year means new start, new way of thinking, new way of looking. In other words, anything, any stupidity from 2011, any pain from the past 12 months, any disappointment, any anger, please, tomorrow evening, look upon all the bad things which have happened to you so far. And at midnight, say to all those negative, painful, difficult experiences, bye-bye, auld lang syne, to the past. Bye-bye, see you, go away. So that you can face the new year. You can make it new. Not the same old, same old, same old. But, you know, just with a much better attitude. A more peaceful, more compassionate, more wise way of looking at life. So you have the choice. So grow. So even though your body starts to fall apart, your mind gets brighter, more compassionate, and more happy. So you can go into your coffin with the biggest smile. Now that is your goal in life. See how happy you can be. Now most undertakers, when you actually die, you know what they usually do, the embalmers, they actually put these chemicals into your muscles. And before they go really hard, they push everything up so it does look like you're smiling. Even though people, you know, some people have said that. Some people say, you know, their father, grandfather never smiled in their life. But now they're in their coffin, they've got a big grin on their face. Are you sure that's, you know, my father? But no, make sure it's a natural one. So by learning how to know the nature of the mind and to know these small little tricks that, you know, in life, it's what you add to it which counts. It's the way you look at things which counts. It's your attitude which you can change. You can't change the world. You can't change your husband. Not really. If you do change them, as I say, you get exactly the same. Same model, same engine inside, only different chassis, that's all. Change your wife, same old problems. Change your job, change the place where you live. Change anything, it's the same old problems. Don't change the things, change the attitudes. That's what you can change, the way you look at life, the way you look at yourself, the way you look at the future. Do that, and you will have a very happy 2555. Ha 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 to you all. Thank you.